Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I welcome Dr. Julia Rose Kraut, lawyer, historian, and the inaugural Judith S. Kaye Fellow for the Historical Society of the New York Courts, to discuss her new book, Threat of Dissent, A History of Ideological Exclusion and Deportation in the United States, published by Harvard University Press just this summer. Welcome to the podcast, Julia.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is a wonderful podcast, and I'm delighted to be talking with you and to be able to share a bit about my new book, Threat of Dissent.
Thanks. It's really great to have you. I enjoyed the book so much. The book argues that ideological exclusion and deportation are rooted in political fear of subversion, and that the U.S. has used exclusion and deportation to suppress what you call the threat of dissent, not dissent, but the threat of it. And the book demonstrates how these tools of exclusion and deportation have been used continuously from the 18th to the 21st centuries, suppressing discussion and speech. And I'm very excited to talk to you about your claims about how the Supreme Court has failed to apply First Amendment principles and precedents. But let's start with some background about you and how you came to write the book. I mean, this is a really nuanced mix of law and history. So how did you come to pick this subject? And how did being both a lawyer and a historian help you write it?
So I can actually trace the origins of my interest in writing about law and history and the interest in ideological exclusion, deportation, to when I was a college student majoring in history at Columbia University 2 decades ago. And I was focused on studying law and history and interested in social movements and the history of radicalism in the United States. And I was very fortunate to study with some brilliant professors, including Eric Foner and the late Alan Brinkley, who encouraged and supported my interdisciplinary approach to studying the past. And I became very interested in the anarchist movement in the United States and the suppression of anarchist speech in the early 20th century. And one of the cases that I read that just fascinated me was about an English anarchist named John Turner, who was excluded from the United States in 1903 under the Alien Immigration Act, which barred anarchists and authorized their deportation. And the act was passed in the wake of the assassination of President William McKinley by a self-proclaimed anarchist named Leon Czolgosz in 1901. And so Turner challenges his exclusion as a violation of the First Amendment and is represented by Clarence Darrow, who takes his case to the Supreme Court, and the court upholds the constitutionality of the law and of Turner's exclusion, stating that Congress holds the power to regulate immigration and to exclude whomever it wishes. And as a foreign non-citizen seeking to enter the United States, Turner does not hold constitutional rights, including First Amendment rights, and he has no standing to challenge his exclusion. And I thought this was so intriguing and that it presented a unique intersection of First Amendment law and immigration that I had never seen before. And so I continue to pursue my interest in both law and history. I go to law school. I decide to get a PhD in history. And this is during the first couple of years of the War on Terror. And what I find is that I'm also reading about foreign scholars who are being barred from coming to the United States under anti-terrorism provisions. And the same arguments that I'm hearing about the fact that this is censorship and concern about these types of restrictions and this is a violation of the First Amendment are the same arguments and challenges that I read about in the John Turner case. And I begin thinking and saying, there's got to be more of a history here. And I delve into the archives and I start researching this issue. And I find a very, very rich history that I can trace from the Alien Friends Act of 1798 all the way through to the War on Terror, and that it provides a window into discussions of national security and sovereignty, xenophobia and immigration, foreign policy, and censorship and dissent. And I decide after I get that PhD that I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be a legal, political, and social history of ideological exclusion, deportation, and that I hope it contributes to a greater understanding of both immigration, First Amendment law, and history.
And somewhere in there, you got a law degree as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, I pursued both. And I knew that I wanted to work on putting law and history together and writing about it. And this was the way to do it. And but this topic, this subject has kind of been part of my life for two decades. And it's now in this book.
Well, and if it's been in process for two decades, it couldn't have come out at a more meaningful time for those in the United States and elsewhere. And we'll talk later in the program about just how relevant it is to today's American politics and the bills that we're passing. This book is so well researched. And as I was reading it, I was thinking of it both as a tool for my own scholarship and also as a book that, though highly nuanced, highly, highly researched, would also be incredibly accessible to students. I'm wondering if you had an aha moment in the archive, that sort of one thing where you picked up a piece of paper or a digital piece of paper and thought, wow.
Yes. And I'm so happy that you found that the book is accessible, because I wrote it with a general audience in mind, but also to be used by academics in their own work, by lawyers, by historians and instructors in the classroom. So I really was focused on trying to explain the law clearly and in an accessible manner. And the aha moment, this is a rich history and I found a lot. But the aha moment, I think, was when I discovered the origins of a legal strategy that was devised in a case that I talk about in chapter 6 regarding the exclusion of a Belgian Marxist economist named Ernest Mandel. And to discover the backstory and to discover who developed this strategy to challenge his exclusion, and then finding similar documents that shed more light, was really such an aha moment that I said I have to devote an entire chapter to this one case, and to really bring this backstory to life and to bring this archival research to the readers.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it, because it's a fantastic chapter and I'm looking forward to focusing on it. Let's start with the sort of big claims for the book. You open it with a story about a prominent Palestinian activist, Omar Barghouti. And he's boarding a plane to give a talk at NYU and Harvard, and he's going to also go to his daughter's wedding in Texas. And despite the fact that he's given many talks in the United States and received prestigious awards, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services tells the U.S. consulate to exclude him. And Barghouti was also a co-founder of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which seeks to pressure Israel to change its policies and treatment of the Palestinians. You use this story, this vignette, as a way to raise questions about the right of a sovereign nation to exclude or deport, the right of NYU or Harvard to engage with him and his ideas, and also whether his exclusion was a suppression of dissent that undermines liberal democracy's commitment to free expression and deliberation. And you write that some see this as, quote, an authentically American tool, unquote. And the book traces the long history of this tool. So I thought we would start with how you define ideological exclusion and how it functions generally before we get into the specifics of a case like Mandel.
Yes, well, I define ideological exclusion deportation as exclusion and deportation based on political beliefs, expressions, and associations. So this isn't religious, but political. And throughout the 20th century, it's often referred to as political exclusions or deportations. But in the past 20, 30 years, it's really been identified as ideological exclusion deportation, which is what I call it in the book. And it really functions as a tool of political repression, and particularly reflects the conflation of foreigners and radicalism, and foreigners being seen as the source of subversion, and that they are importers of dissent and radicalism, and they are the spreaders of subversion within the United States. And they are also very vulnerable. So what you find is that as the United States begins suppressing speech and expression, whether it is anarchist speech or communist speech, the United States also uses ideological exclusion deportation as part of their suppression efforts. And this tool of political repression endures over time. And I make an argument that the interpretation of ideological exclusion and deportation as an immigration issue rather than as a First Amendment issue by the majority of the Supreme Court is what helps it endure.
And before we get to that fascinating part of the book, I have to say that was for me the enormous takeaway. And it changed everything that I read from the time I read the book. So thank you for that, the distinction about First Amendment and immigration law in the court. You make a couple of distinctions that I think will be helpful to get out in the open. You talk about explicit versus implicit laws and also a third type. And I was wondering if you could get those definitions out for listeners. And also you talk about three categories of discretion, prosecutorial, ultimate, and interpretive. And I think you're arguing that those come together uniquely in ideological exclusion. So I'd love for the listeners to get that as well before we move on.
Sure. And that's something that I outline in the introduction of my book to be as clear as possible, because what I'm trying to do is to explore the underlying dynamics of ideological exclusion deportation and how they're functioning and being used. And so in implicit and explicit restrictions, I'm the one who makes that distinction. And an explicit restriction would be a statute or a federal restriction that explicitly excludes a particular group, like anarchists or communists or advocates of a particular ideology. An implicit is a little bit more open-ended and leaves a lot of power and discretion in the public official to bar or reject someone who is detrimental to the United States or someone who poses a national security risk. And it's really dependent on that official's interpretation and judgment on who poses that risk. And that leads into the discretion. And what I do is I use the legal scholar Daniel Kantstrom's three definitions of discretion: prosecutorial, ultimate, and interpretive discretion. And prosecutorial discretion is just the discretion by a public official to either defer, delay, or prevent a deportation. Ultimate discretion is the power of a public official to admit or exclude a foreign non-citizen. They hold ultimate discretion and that power. Interpretive discretion is the interpretation by that public official of an implicit or explicit restriction. So interpreting the law to determine whether a particular foreign non-citizen is going to fall under it for exclusion and deportation purposes. Now, you also, there was a third category of exclusion deportation, and that's what I call also selective or retaliatory exclusion deportation. And what this is a kind of a targeting of an individual based on his or her expressions, beliefs, or associations, and exclusion or deportation as kind of a retaliatory motivation for that expression, belief, and association. And often that those deportations or exclusions aren't necessarily under an implicit or explicit restriction, but maybe might be under something else, like overstaying a visa or some other infraction, and that individual is selected for exclusion or deportation, but based on their views. So what you're doing is you have to really kind of look at the motivation behind that exclusion and deportation and the selection of that person.
What I really like about the book is the way that you take these small decisions and actions against individuals and make the case for their importance in terms of the core values of the United States. In other words, that our national identity or our identity as a nation that upholds the First Amendment, that upholds the free exchange of ideas, Oliver Wendell Holmes and the marketplace of ideas, etc. All of this is at stake in the exclusion of others. And I want to ask you two questions. One is little, which is that about you choice of vocabulary. I talk to a lot of authors and they have to make big choices about the terms they use. You use the word foreigners, and I'm wondering the extent to which that was a choice, what else was out there, what other alternatives. And then second, the bigger question having to do with what is at stake. Is it, as I've said, is it national identity? Would you say that it's more than that?
Well, using foreigners was absolutely a deliberate decision. And the law in immigration law usually refers to non-citizen immigrants or visitors as aliens. And that term has really kind of fallen out of favor and is really considered something that is almost offensive to refer to a foreign non-citizen as an alien. I decided at the beginning not to use that and just use foreigners. Now, when I talk about the law, I give the name of the law. So if it's an Alien Immigration Act, that's what I use. But when I'm referring to people, I use foreigners or foreign non-citizens. and that was a deliberate choice. So in terms of this argument, does this, you know, ideological exclusion deportation undermine our liberal democratic values and free expression and exchange that is essential to self-government and undermines our reputation abroad and identity as a nation of immigrants and depicts the United States as fearful, insecure, and repressive? That's not just kind of my argument, but that actually is the argument of those who are either being excluded or deported, or those who are challenging ideological exclusion and deportation on their behalf. That I find this again and again and again throughout this history of this argument. Those who are advocating for such exclusion, deportation, are saying, no, we need to exclude or deport to preserve the nation and to protect it against subversives and those seeking to undermine democracy. And those who are challenging such exclusions and deportations are saying, don't you understand that by this form of censorship, and this type of suppression, this political repressive tool that you're using, you are in fact undermining the very values that you are seeking to protect. And this is an argument that runs throughout the book and this history. And I think that for many people, it's the very identity of the country as a nation of immigrants, but also one that champions free expression, and the reputation of the United States also abroad that is at stake. And that's what I bring out in the book.
No, and it's beautifully done with so many different examples that show both the continuity, but also the breaks in continuity and the sort of new developments over time. I want to just hone in on one other thing, which has to do with the role of the Supreme Court. In the last few weeks, Americans who watch the Supreme Court have been receiving all sorts of opinions that affect the extent to which the president has the ability to limit or make changes to immigration laws, for example, DACA. But in your book, the Supreme Court, over time, there's a bunch of players, institutions. The ACLU is a player in the book, but SCOTUS is a player. And I was wondering if before we go into the Mandela case, if you could just talk a little bit about how it is that the Supreme Court has played this role and how its decisions to treat this as immigration as opposed to free speech in general has played out before we go to the specifics.
Sure. And what you see also in these recent decisions and watching the Supreme Court, that a lot of the issues that I mentioned before about discretion are coming into play here, especially when you're talking about immigration issues. Now, in immigration law, you have something called the plenary power doctrine, which is something I explain in the book. And this is established in the late 19th century by Supreme Court decisions, including those that uphold Chinese exclusion. And what this doctrine states is that Congress has the power to regulate immigration, to exclude and deport, based on its national sovereignty and inherent right to self-preservation, and that the executive will enforce those restrictions and has the discretion to do so, and that the judiciary should defer to the decision-making of those executive officials as well as to Congress's power. And what people argue over time is that this is actually, in a way, a violation of the separation of powers and undermines checks and balances. This insulates immigration from substantive judicial review and certain due process protections. And but this doctrine has a hold. And that's very important in these cases, as I show in the book.
I don't want to open a whole big chapter, but can you just give us the two-paragraph version of Chinese exclusion? Because so many people listening to the podcast are familiar with other forms of exclusion that come later. But there's a hole often with Chinese exclusion, and I was just wondering if you could give us the briefest version of it before we move on.
Ooh, well, there are whole books on Chinese exclusion that you should go and certainly read. What you have is in the late 19th century, as the federal government begins to restrict immigration, the exclusion of the Chinese, along with other exclusions that have been instituted by the states. I should remind listeners that immigration has never really been open. That before the federal government starts regulating immigration, the states are regulating immigration from the colonial period through the 19th century. And particularly, there's a concern about Chinese immigration in the West through the 1840s and into the late 19th century. And a lot of this is concerns and racism against the Chinese and concerns about labor competition. And there's a real push, especially by those out in California and the West Coast, to restrict Chinese immigration, skilled and unskilled laborers from our shores. And so the states kind of lead the push and pressure the federal government, and the federal government answers and begins to restrict Chinese immigration, specifically of skilled and unskilled laborers in the late 19th century. So challenges to that exclusion come before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court upholds the right of Congress to exclude, including to exclude the Chinese, and establishes this plenary power doctrine. And what's so important for my story is that when the Supreme Court is confronted with challenges to ideological exclusion and deportation, it sees those cases as an immigration issue, not as a First Amendment issue. So what that means is it's going to apply the plenary power doctrine and not necessarily First Amendment legal protections. And that helps the ideological exclusion deportation laws and specific exclusions and deportation survive and to be used as a political repression tool. And what you find is that the Supreme Court is citing the Chinese exclusion cases in its decisions, saying, oh, no, the Congress has the right to exclude and the judiciary should defer to this power and the decisions of the executive under the plenary power doctrine. And this is longstanding doctrine. So what's important for me in the book is to start out talking about the establishment of this doctrine to set the stage also for my discussion of ideological exclusion deportation and how the Supreme Court is interpreting those restrictions.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And for listeners who don't follow the Supreme Court, is the Supreme Court still citing the precedents from the Chinese exclusion cases?
I've noticed that they, in the footnotes, not so much. But what they are doing is they're citing the reaffirmation of the plenary power doctrine in the 1950s. And so those
yes,
cases
no,
that
my
site,
that well.
Yes, you said, so it's very interesting to see. And that's what makes this history, I think, so important.
Yeah, let's turn to what's one of the most fascinating chapters in the book. And so, you know, for those who don't have the book in front of them, although I really encourage you to pick up a copy, it's really fantastic reading. It's a real page turner, as well as being a great scholarly achievement. Let's talk a little bit about, so for those who don't have the book in front of them, we're going to jump in the middle, but Julia in the book will takes you through from the 18th century to the 1960s as to how we got to this place that we're going to pick up with here. So in 1969, a 46-year-old Belgian Marxist economist named Ernest Mandel applies for a visa. Students at Stanford had invited him to come to a conference on speaking about language, technology, and the third world. And also to participate in a debate with none other than John Kenneth Galbraith. And while he's waiting for his visa, he gets more invitations from Amherst and Princeton and Columbia and the New School and MIT. But Mandel never gets the visa. And you claim that this is a case of ideological exclusion in the late 20th century by the Nixon administration. So let's start with, so why would Nixon want to prevent Mandel from debating John Kenneth Galbraith? And so how does this begin? And then we'll move to how the ACLU and the courts get involved.
Yes. Well, this is a fascinating case, and that's why I spend so much time on it, because it tells you so much about the dynamics at play in ideological exclusion and the longevity of some of these laws that continue to be used. So what happens is that Ernest Mandel has visited the United States before. He's visited in 1962 and then in 1968. And what ends up happening now in 1969 is that he discovers that he's excluded, and then through communication with the consulate, that he has always been inadmissible under a section of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, referred to as the McCarran-Walter Act, which bars advocates of world communism. And this act was passed at the height of McCarthyism, is still on the books. It survives immigration reform in the mid-1960s. And now the Nixon administration is using it. And what's happened is that Mandel discovers that he's always been excluded, but he's been granted waivers of inadmissibility to come to the United States. And this time, the Nixon administration says no. And what Mandel discovers is that he didn't know anything about the waivers and that there were restrictions on him straying from his itinerary. And he tells the State Department, I had no idea. And if you let me in now, I will stick to my itinerary and the confines of my restricted visa under this waiver. And should be good. You know, I didn't know, and now I do. And the State Department says, okay. And the Justice Department and the Attorney General, John N. Mitchell, says no. And John N. Mitchell holds tremendous ultimate discretion to decide who can be admitted or excluded and to grant this waiver. And refuses. And it's really unclear why, but it really seems to be part of the Nixon administration's desire to suppress the New Left and is concerned about protests on college campuses and really doesn't see an incentive amongst their supporters to admit Ernest Mandel. And so this case makes national news. And the real focus is on how to challenge Mandel's exclusion. And what I do is I go through all of the attention about this case and the backstory using archival research and a Freedom of Information Act request and disclosures. And what you find is that there's a major hurdle to challenging this exclusion, which I talked about earlier with that John Turner anarchist case, because Mendel does not hold constitutional rights. He does not, he cannot make a claim to challenge his exclusion under the First Amendment. But the professors in the United States who have invited him do have a claim. And so I talk about the lawyer Leonard Boudin and his young associate David Rosenberg, and it's Rosenberg who devises this strategy for the American professors to challenge Mendel's exclusion as a violation of their First Amendment right to receive information and to hear.
It's brilliant. I'm just going to interrupt you. It's brilliant. That part of the book, it is just, it is so akin to reading about the NAACP's thoughts about, okay, how do we create precedents to overturn desegregation? And there, they have this sort of plan ahead. And here, you see this kind of on-the-ground moment of how are we going to argue this? And I just think that this part of the book is so valuable to understand how it is that the rule of law functions. And we can make fun of lawyers and tell lots of jokes and have lots of New Yorker cartoons about them. But here you see how figuring out the way around standing, figuring out what is the legal issue, becomes this very, very productive. In a lot of ways, it pushes them to be talking about liberal democracy and the importance of the free exchange of ideas. It's just, I loved this part of the book.
Thank you. And it's one of my favorites. And that I really worked hard to not only give the entire backstory, including not only devising this strategy and the professors, you have Norman Birnbaum from Amherst. You also have Noam Chomsky from MIT, who are the American professor plaintiffs. Leonard Boudin, whose name should sound familiar, one of the most famous civil rights and civil liberties attorneys in the mid-20th century, who also defended Dr. Spock and Julian Bond, and also Daniel Ellsberg in his espionage case later on, really involved in these important First Amendment cases, as well as establishing the precedent for freedom of travel and striking down passport restrictions and the right to receive information. And so Boudin is key here in terms of he's also helped establish the precedent that he and Rosenberg are going to use to challenge Mendel's exclusion. And what I also love is that Boudin is very aware of the Turner case, so much so that he actually, during oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court, makes a reference to the Turner case and says, I wish I could have argued that case.
You Fascinating. Know?
Right. Yeah. And I saw that as I look at the transcript of those oral arguments, I say, I got to put this in the book. Because what happens is that's what also is so important about telling this long history, which is not only as a writer bringing this history to a reader, I'm making those connections. But the lawyers and activists and organizations and those excluded and deported are also making those connections over time. And so what's the best part too is that I also show the backstory in the Supreme Court, which is how do they wrestle with these issues and how do we get to the decision of Klondike versus Mendel in 1972.
Well, I'm going to say that the listeners are going to have to read the book for the backstory Supreme Court part because it's amazing. But I do want you to tell everybody how this case came out before we move to the end of the book, which has to do with the Trump administration and the extreme vetting, including the travel ban. So tell us how this case came out And then tell us a little bit about how all this plays out in our present day. And then we'll also talk about the No Ban Act, which happened just 2 days ago, because we're recording this podcast on July 24th.
Sure. Well, there's kind of good news and bad news here with the Mendel case. Now, the good news is that this brilliant strategy of having those within the United States and those who have invited Mendel to come and speak, they succeed in the fact that the court says, yes, you have standing. You can challenge exclusion as a violation of your First Amendment rights. And that leads to a pathway to challenge exclusion, which we still use. So if you see kind of exclusion challenges, it's not necessarily by the foreign non-citizen who is trying to get into the United States, but usually has as the lead either a state or an organization within the United States. It says, I'm injured or my rights are being violated. So look for that. But this is what the strategy leads to. So the court says, yes, go forward. This is the way to challenge. But it doesn't mean that Mendel can come to the United States. The court upholds his exclusion. And the justice who writes the opinion, Justice Harry Blackmun, issues a new standard and says, you know, we're going to curb the attorney general's ultimate discretion to exclude and to deny or grant these waivers. But that attorney general and public officials must have a facially legitimate and bona fide reason to deny a waiver and exclude. Now, this is lower than current First Amendment standards and the application of something called strict scrutiny, which requires the government to narrowly tailor its restrictions to serve a compelling government interest. But it's a standard nonetheless. And so what you find is going forward is that lawyers, when they challenge exclusion cases, either say that the exclusion falls short of the facially legitimate and bona fide reason, or they say that reason doesn't apply and they use another part of the law. So sometimes they use this Mendel precedent and sometimes they say, well, Mendel doesn't apply. But this case is so important because it's still cited as precedent, and knowing its backstory and how the court arrives at this holding is essential to understanding exclusion and challenges to exclusion.
So tell us about the Trump administration and how is extreme vetting ideological exclusion?
Okay, well, this is actually a challenge for historians. We say, how close to the present can you get? And it was very tricky to try to bring the manuscript up so far to the present. But I was determined that I really needed to go into the travel ban case and its decision, a travel ban under the Trump administration, often referred to as the Muslim ban, is part of what Donald Trump referred to as extreme vetting during his campaign. And the travel ban, which was first instituted as an executive order in 2017, the suspending entry to seven, at the time, Muslim-majority countries under a provision of the McCarran-Walter Act, 212F. And so what you see here is that we are still living under the McCarran-Walter Act, incorporated into our current immigration nationality legislation. And that provision authorizes the president through proclamation to suspend entry to or place restrictions on entry if the president determines that such entry would be detrimental to U.S. interest. And what you have here is, again, a case of how much power the executive holds And are there checks on that power? And so this travel ban case has less to do with ideological exclusion. It's more based on kind of religious exclusion and really a focus on exclusion based on national security. But what's significant here is that you have another challenge to this ultimate discretion and power by the executive to exclude. And the Supreme Court is once again confronted with whether it's going to defer to the president. Are there any curbs on this power under 212F? And that's what that decision is, that you can read about really wrestles with. And so it's a nice complement to the Mandel decision too.
Yeah, no, it's a really great way to end the book. And I know it's hard, and it's very hard to write a good conclusion. You've been working on the book for a long time, and you're up against the deadline. And sometimes those conclusions aren't as meaningful as they might be. This one is really terrific. And when you talk about religion versus ideological, it's such a blurry line there, right? If we're going to have conversation and we're going to talk about very controversial issues, and we come at them from different perspectives based on our upbringings, our beliefs. In fact, there's a lot of overlap there. I want to ask you about something that clearly was after the deadline of the book. 2 days ago, the House passed the No Ban Act for my American politics people. It's 2214, they know. The bill imposes limitations on the president's authority. So it's exactly what you're talking about, this conflict between the powers. So the bill would say that the president's authority to suspend or restrict, and I'll use the word aliens because they do in the bill, because it's the legal word, from entering the U.S. And terminating certain actions is like they're going to limit what the president can do. And it allows the individual present in the U.S. who is being unlawfully harmed by such restrictions to sue in federal court. So I wanted your insights on this bill and how you see it. Is this ideological exclusion? Is this about executive versus congressional power? And do you think that this can be successful? Would the Supreme Court see it within Congress's purview? Not saying that this can get past the Senate, highly unlikely, but if it could, how would it fall out given the long history that you've looked at in the book?
Well, I was very lucky that I was just able to slide in the No Ban Act right before I submitted the manuscript. So I was able to just get it in there because I knew it was going to be significant, especially in light of the travel ban decision. And so when I saw this, I knew that this was something very, very important and also something to be watching, and is a great first step in trying to place limitations and checks and oversight over the president's authority. I think that the power is in Congress to revise and make immigration reform and to regulate immigration. So that Congress holds that power. So we'll see what ends up happening with this act. And I hope it is successful. But what's most significant about this act is the inclusion of more oversight and subjecting the president's actions under this proclamation power under 212F to strict scrutiny and limitations and much more checks and the ability to really hold the president and the executive accountable for exclusions under this presidential proclamation power. And that is very important, especially in moving forward. As we begin to think more about immigration reform, we need to address the plenary power doctrine, this judicial deference, and not leave it to the courts to try to provide more oversight and raise that scrutiny level. That's really up to Congress. We've seen that the courts have kind of failed to raise the scrutiny level and provide that oversight. And it's really Congress with its power to pass legislation that can do it. And that's what we see in the No Ban Act. So I think that ultimately, as we move forward, whatever happens with the act, hopefully in reform efforts, we can begin to push for more of this oversight and more of this check on ultimate and unfettered discretion held by the executive.
Well, thank you so much, Julia. It's so rare that somebody writes a book for two decades and it's published in the weeks in which the book is really needed by everybody. And I highly recommend this book as a well-researched, beautiful use of images that kind of take your breath away. And a really high level of sophistication mixed with this accessibility. That's really hard to do, and you did it. There's something very random about our backgrounds that sort of clash, and I'm just going to mention it. I rarely do this, but I'm going to anyway. You're the Judith S. Kay Fellow, and I was interning for Mario M. Cuomo in the early 80s. In the 1982 election, he had, very much like Joe Biden, made a pledge. And the pledge was to appoint a woman to the U.S., to the New York State Court of Appeals, which in New York is the highest court, and there were no women on it. Anyway, I was an intern. I was pulled in for the press conference. I got to shake her hand, and I was thrilled to see her name on the back of your book. She became a very, very important judge in the state of New York, and I would be excited to have her name on my resume the way you do. So thank you so much for joining us to talk about the book.
Thank you so much, Susan. It was delightful to have the chance to talk with you. I am so happy that you enjoyed reading the book, and I can't ask for a better endorsement. And I was very proud to have become the Judith S. Kay Fellow for the Historical Society of the New York Courts back in 2016, and to have met Judith Kay when I was a college student, just thinking about, the first time. And I remember I met her, and we had a brief conversation, and she was so supportive and encouraging, and especially of young people. And so, well, I'm no longer a fellow at the society. I do still serve on its education committee, and I had the chance to teach students as a fellow. And I always tell them about Judith S. Kay and talk about how she founded the society and cared deeply about educating young people about legal history and the importance of the court system.
Well, thank you so much. And I think the book can reach everyone, including those students. The book is Threat of Dissent, A History of Ideological Exclusion and Deportation in the United States, published by Harvard University Press 2020, just came out this month. It is available everywhere you know it's available, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. As you know, I'm a big fan of bookshop.org, which supports brick and mortar bookstores that are really impacted by COVID-19. So think about purchasing the book and having it mailed to your door and supporting those bookstores, but get in anywhere you can. And thank you again so much, Julia. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much, Susan.